That's correct. What day of the week is it? Are you ready? If the Senate would please come to order. Okay, first item is messages from the House.
Thank you. February the 25th, 2015, from the House of Representatives. Message, third reading, passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below pass the House on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 43, Wyoming Telecommunication Act Revision, ayes 59, excused 1. Senate File 59, Wyoming Public Television Endowment Accounts, ayes 45, noes 14, excused 1. Senate File 65, Savings and Loan Associations, ayes 55, noes 1, excused 1. Senate File 82, Funeral Services Practitioner Act Amendments, ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1. And Senate File 97, Department of Transportation Communication Facilities, ayes 45, noes 13, excused 1, conflict 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
We have conference committee reports. Oh, we're still going. Yeah. I didn't mean to cut you off.
We got a lot of stuff.
Okay.
February the 25th, 2015, from the House of Representatives. Message number 366, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 17, Resident Contractor Materials Preference. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 54, noes 5, excused 6. Message number 371, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 84, Enhanced Recovery Carbon Dioxide Certification. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 57, noes 1, excused 1, conflict 1. House respectfully asks Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Message number 373, concurrence requested. Senate file number 111, summary probate proceedings. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 59, excused 1. Message number 374, concurrence requested. Senate File 120, Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 55, noes 1, excused 1. And message number 375, concurrence requested. Senate File 54, Election Code Revisions. The Senate file listed above passed on a third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 52, noes 7, excused 1. House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. February the 25th, 2015, from the House of Representatives. Message number 376, concurrence passed. Mr. President, the House did concur on Senate amendments to the bill listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill number 32, Hemp Extract Regulation. Ayes 54, noes 5, excused 1. Concurrence passed. House Bill number 44, Emergency 9/11 Fees Prepaid Wireless. Ayes 43, noes 16, excused 1. Concurrence passed. House Bill number 77, Wyoming Retirement System Veteran Service Credit. Ayes 59, excused 1. Message number 380, concurrence passed. House Bill 88, Health Provider Recruiting Programs. Ayes 57, noes 2, excused 1. And concurrence passed. House Bill number 225, Highway Patrol Security Duties. Ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. Miss February 25th, 2015, from the House of Representatives. Message number 377, concurrence failed. Mr. President, House Bill number 38, PAC campaign limits and funding. The House failed to concur on Senate amendments to the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes 20, noes 39, excused 1. House requests the Senate appoint a conference committee number 1 to meet with a like committee from the House to report recommended amendments to the bill for final consideration by both houses. From the House of Representatives, message number 382, Joint Conference Committee report adopted. Mr. President, House Bill 22, Disabled Veteran License Plates. The House adopted the Joint Conference Committee number 1 report on the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes 57, noes 2, excused 1. Do you want that Joint Conference Committee? You want the reading? That's separate. From the House of Representatives, message 383, Joint Conference Committee of a report not adopted. Mr. President, Senate file number 13, Method of Execution 1. The House failed to adopt the Joint Conference Committee number 1 report on the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes 30, noes 29, excused 1. The House requests the Senate appoint a new conference committee to meet with like committee from the House. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. From the House of Representatives, message number 355. Concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate file 42, Task Force on Mineral Taxes. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 59, excused 1. House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
With that order of business of concurrences, the first item is a concurrence report, which is message number 255. It's on Senate file 42. Senator Peterson, are you ready?
I am, Mr. President.
If the reading clerk would please read in the report. Here's my copy. That's actually a message.
February the 24th, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number 355, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate file 42, Task Force on Mineral Taxes. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 59, excused 1. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Senator Peterson.
Yes, President, I would move this concurrence and ask for the body to vote aye. This is the Senate File 42 on the Task Force on Mineral Taxes, and our revenue committees got together, and basically what we tried to do on this side, Mr. President, was try to pull a fast one over on Management Council by not involving them in some of these decisions, not bothering them with such trivial things. But the House Committee felt that it was probably wise and prudent that we involve the Management Council in helping us spend this money on this task force if there were some outside expertise needed and items like that. And so on page 2, line 20, we add, with the prior approval of the Management Council. Page 5, line 17, similar language, but we say the Management Council may use a portion of this appropriation to engage the services of research firms or consulting or other expertise determined necessary to carry out the purpose of this act, and we delete the rest of that sentence. So the change wasn't major. It's just basically a formality of making sure the Management Council, we can't have rogue committees out there, Mr. President. So that's the change, and I'd ask for your favorable consideration and vote aye on this concurrence.
Discussion on the message. The motion is that the Senate do concur with Senate file number 42, and you've been asked to vote aye. If the chief clerk would please call the roll.
Anderson, District 2.
Aye.
Anderson, District 28.
Aye.
Barnard.
Aye.
Bebout.
Aye.
Burns.
Aye.
Case.
Aye.
Christensen.
Aye.
Coe.
Aye.
Cooper.
Aye.
Kraft.
Aye.
Dockstetter.
Aye.
Driscoll.
Aye.
Emmerich. Escobel?
Aye.
Geis? Geis? Geis?
Geis?
Geis? Hastert? Hicks? Hicks? Johnson, excused. Kinski?
Aye.
Landon?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Pappas?
Aye.
Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Rothfuss?
Aye.
Scott?
No.
Von Fladern?
Aye.
Wasserberger?
Aye.
President Nicholas?
Aye.
Closing vote? Closing vote closed. 28 aye, 1 no, 1 excused.
By your vote, you have concurred with Senate file 42. I got to tell you it's funnier watching it up from here. I'm like, really? What are you looking at? It's got to be here to see the funniness. Okay, we're at Senate file 17. Senator Bebout, are you ready on Senate File 17, Resident Contractor Materials Preference?
Mr. President, I am.
If the reading clerk would please read in the message.
February the 25th, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number 366, concurrence requested, Mr. President. Senate File 17, Resident Contractor Materials Preference. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 54, noes 5, excused 1. House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendment. Tricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Discussion on the amendment, Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move message number 366, concurrence requested on Senate file 17, resident contractor materials preference, and ask the body to vote aye. Mr. President, what they did, if you look at the bill, you go on page 1, line 14, the language was, Wyoming materials shall be allowed. They struck, replaced the word allowed with applied, so it'll read, Wyoming materials shall be applied. I ask you to concur.
Any discussion on the request? The motion is that the Senate do concur with Senate file number 17, resident contractor materials preference, and you've been asked to vote aye. If the chief clerk would please call the roll.
Anderson, District 2.
Aye.
Anderson, District 28.
Aye.
Barnard.
Aye.
Bebout.
Aye.
Burns.
Aye.
Case.
Aye.
Christensen.
Aye.
Coe.
Aye.
Cooper.
Aye.
Kraft.
Aye.
Dockstetter.
Aye.
Driscoll.
Aye.
Emmerich. Escobel?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hicks?
Aye.
Johnson, excused. Kinski?
Aye.
Landon?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Pappas?
Aye.
Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Rothfuss?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Von Platern?
Aye.
Wasserberger?
Aye.
President Nicholas?
Aye.
Closing vote? Closing vote closed. 29 aye, 1 excused.
By your vote, you have concurred with Senate File Number 17, Resident Contractor Materials Preference. The next conference report is on Senate File 84, Enhanced Recovery, Carbon Dioxide. Senator Von Flatern, are you ready?
Yes, I am, Mr. President.
Would the reading clerk please read the message?
February the 25th, 2015, from the House of Representatives. Message number 371, concurrence requested, Mr. President. Senate File 84, Enhanced Recovery Carbon Dioxide Certification. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 57, noes 1, excused 1, conflict 1. House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendment. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move message number 371 to Senate File 84, Enhanced Recovery Carbon Dioxide Certification. Ask the Senate to concur and ask for your aye vote on this. What it did was something we missed was add rulemaking to this bill. So they went on page 1, of course, line 4, and added insert providing for rulemaking. Page 1, line 14, they put a subparagraph, little a, so they could break that part out. And then on page 2, after line 11, they put a subparagraph again, b, and prior to commission entering in an order pursuant to this subsection, the commission shall, in consultation with the Department of Environmental Quality, create rules. So that's all they did, and I asked for the aye vote on this.
Any discussion on the message? The motion is that the Senate do concur with Senate File 84, Enhanced Recovery Carbon Dioxide Certification, and you've been asked to vote aye. If the Chief Clerk would please call the roll.
Anderson, District 2.
Aye.
Anderson, District 28.
Aye.
Barnard.
Aye.
Bebout.
Aye.
Burns.
Aye.
Case.
No.
Christensen.
Aye.
Coe. Cooper?
Aye.
Kraft?
Aye.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Driscoll?
Aye.
Emmerich?
Aye.
Escobel?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Astert?
Aye.
Hicks?
Aye.
Johnson excused Kinski?
Aye.
Landon?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Pappas?
Aye.
Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Rothfuss?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Von Platern?
Aye.
Wasserberger?
Aye.
President Nicholas?
Aye.
Closing vote? Closing vote closed. 28 aye, 1 no, 1 excused.
By your vote, you have concurred with Senate File 84, Enhanced Recovery Carbon Dioxide Certification. Next item is message number 374, addressing Senate File 120. Senator Ross, are you ready on that bill?
I am, Mr. President.
If the reading clerk would please read in the message.
February the 25th, 2015, from the House of Representatives. Message number 374, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 120, Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 55, noes 1. Excused 1. House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendment. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Senator Roth.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move concurrence on message number 374 in reference to Senate File 120, Uniform Interstate Family Support Act, and ask the body to vote aye. You see a page of amendments here. They are all technical corrections to a very lengthy bill. The only thing I can say is get this out of my hair.
Was there any discussion on that, what was potentially the most magnificent speech I've ever heard? There no discussion? The question, the motion on the floor is the Senate do, did you say yes or no?
Yes.
Yes, okay. The motion is that the Senate do concur with Senate File 120, Uniform Interstate Family Support Act, and you've been asked to vote aye. If the Chief Clerk would please call the roll.
Anderson, District 2.
Aye.
Anderson, District 28.
Aye.
Barnard.
Aye.
Bebout.
Aye.
Burns.
Aye.
Case.
Aye.
Christensen.
Aye.
Coe.
Aye.
Cooper.
Aye.
Kraft.
Aye.
Dockstetter.
Aye.
Driscoll.
Aye.
Emmerich.
Aye.
Escobel.
Aye.
Geis.
Aye.
Hastert.
Aye.
Hicks.
Aye.
Johnson excused Kinski.
Aye.
Landon.
Aye.
Meyer.
Aye.
Pappas.
Aye.
Perkins.
Aye.
Peterson.
Aye.
Ross.
Aye.
Rothfuss.
Aye.
Scott.
Aye.
Von Platen.
Aye.
Wasserberger.
Aye.
President Nicholas.
Aye.
Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 29 aye, 1 excused.
By your vote, you have concurred with Senate File 120, Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. Next item is message number 373, addressing summary probate proceedings. Senator Perkins, are you ready?
Yes, I am, Mr. President.
If the reading clerk would please read the message in.
February the 25th, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number 373, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 111, Summary Probate Proceedings. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 59, excused 1. House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendment. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move message 373, concurrence request, and move for Senate File 111, Summary Probate Proceedings. I move that the body, request the body do concur, and we vote aye. What we did, the eagle eye, with this good little Senate bill, our Senate file went down to the House. The eagle eyes in the House found a typographical error, and we need to make instead of distributes, it should be distributees. That's the extent of their corrections. I say it's a typographical correction, would ask the body to vote aye.
Any questions of this discussion? The motion is the Senate do concur with Senate File number 111, Summary Probate Proceedings, and you've been asked to vote aye. If the Chief Clerk would please call the roll.
Anderson, District 2.
Aye.
Anderson, District 28.
Aye.
Barnard.
Aye.
Bebout.
Aye.
Burns.
Aye.
Case.
Aye.
Christensen.
Aye.
Coe.
Aye.
Cooper. Kraft,
aye.
Dockstetter, Driscoll,
aye.
Emmerich,
aye.
Escobel,
aye.
Geis,
aye.
Hastert,
aye.
Hicks,
aye.
Johnson excused Kinski,
aye.
Landon,
aye.
Meyer,
aye.
Pappas,
aye.
Perkins,
aye.
Peterson,
aye.
Ross,
aye.
Rothfuss,
aye.
Scott,
aye.
Von Platen,
aye.
Wasserberger, President Nicholas.
Aye.
Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 29 aye, 1 excused.
By your vote, you have voted to concur with Senate File 111, Summary Probate Proceedings. I think we're now at that item or that place of business for Joint Conference Committee reports.
This is, there we are.
Senator Meyer, are you ready on Joint Conference Committee report to House Bill 22?
Yes, I am, Mr. President.
If the reading clerk would please read in the message or the report.
Joint Conference Committee report, House Bill number 22, Disabled Veteran License Plates, reference Senate message number 244. Signing for the House, Representative Dave Zwanitzer, Representative Ponal. Signing for the Senate, Senators Meyer, Burns, and Johnson.
Senator Meyer.
Mr. President, I move the adoption of the reference Senate message 244 for House Bill 22, Joint Conference Report 1. Mr. President, how we handle this is that I talked to some of the House members before we met, found out what their concerns were, went into the statutes with staff, and I think we came up with a pretty good compromise here. As it left the Senate, you could have one additional license plate for either a motorcycle, multi-purpose vehicle, car, or truck. The compromise was to take it down to a motorcycle or multi-purpose vehicle. We had a little bit of drafting error over here on the Senate side concerning the clarification of only one license plate on an annual basis. And so we clarified that, so the House was happy with that. There was actually some current language. It's not the way that the language has been interpreted over the past several years, but we gave them that one because it essentially didn't do much in that respect. As you can tell, we're short one House member. In the tradition of the Transportation Commission, we said it was the Senate's way or the highway, Mr. President. So, har, 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 har. So, Mr. President, I would ask that the Senate vote aye.
Any questions or discussion on the report? There being none, the motion is the Senate do adopt the Joint Conference Report number 244 to referencing House Bill 22, and you've been asked to vote aye. The Chief Clerk will please call the roll.
Anderson, District 2.
Aye.
Anderson, District 28.
Aye.
Barnard.
Aye.
Bebout.
Aye.
Burns.
Aye.
Case.
Aye.
Christensen.
Aye.
Coe.
Aye.
Cooper.
Aye.
Kraft.
Aye.
Dockstetter.
Aye.
Driscoll.
Aye.
Emmerich.
Aye.
Escobel. Geis?
Aye.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hicks?
Aye.
Johnson excused Kinski?
Aye.
Landon?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Pappas?
Aye.
Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Rothfuss?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Von Platern?
Aye.
Wasserberger?
Aye.
President Nicholas?
Aye.
Closing vote? Closing. Vote closed, 28 aye, 1 no, 1 excused.
By your vote, you have adopted Joint Conference Committee report to House Bill 22. References, reference Senate message number 244. Next item is reports from standing committees.
February the 25th, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Mineral Business Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 108, Trespass Landowner Liability, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28, Cole, Cooper, Rothfuss, Von Platern, Senator Von Platern, Chairman. February the 25th, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred House Bill 162 engrossed, Providers Order of Life-Sustaining Treatment, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Kraft, Driscoll, Landon, Peterson, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman. February the 25th, 2015. Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred House Bill 183 engrossed, Insurance Coverage Early Refills of Prescription Eye Drops, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Kraft, Driscoll, Landon, Peterson, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman. February the 25th, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 12, Rules and Procedures, to whom was referred House Joint Resolution 4, Balanced Budget Amendment Resolution, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Nicholas, and Perkins. No, Senators Kraft and Rotha, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 25th, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 12, Rules and Procedures, to whom was referred House Bill 121 engrossed, Article 5 Convention Limitations, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Nicholas, and Perkins. No, Senators Kraft and Rotha, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 25th, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 158 engrossed, Sexual Assault Custody Rights, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Von Fladern. No, Senator Hicks and Kinski, Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Conference Committee appointments. The Conference Committee for Senate File Number 81, Kevin's Law, which relates to message number 359, is as follows. Chairman Johnson, Case, and Perkins. That's it. They clear the box. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, with that order. Hold on. Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. President. Just an additional message on that earlier message from the House on 383, Senate File 13. We were told that one of the members made a mistake and they were asking for a do-over. So if you so choose to send that committee back down there, they promised.
Say that again? They want a bill back to do a do-over?
They'd like a do-over. One of their members made a mistake and voted the wrong way on Senate File 13. They said if we came back, they'd pave the hall with rose petals.
Well, you have to talk to me later about that. That's a privilege of the floor, or you actually want to take the bill back yourself?
Your request
is noted.
Mr. President, if it suits you, the same committee would be glad to take that work up again.
I got to find out more about it. I mean, I heard your request. I don't know that we do do-overs. Maybe we do. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that order of business of consideration of bills on general file.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move the Senate resolve itself in the committee hall to discuss bills on general file.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senator Ross. Senator Anderson, 28.
Is this the first bill?
Committee of the Whole will please come to order. First bill for our consideration is House Bill 64. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill number 64, UCC Title 1 and Title 7 revisions. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Lexington Political Subdivision, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hicks, Meyer, Pappas, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure?
Thank you, Mr.
Little Mike there.
Thank you.
Mr. Case. Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 64, UCC Title 1 and 7 revisions. As you can see, the excellent work on this bill, and you can see that it's single-spaced and not double-spaced. And it would be twice as long. But for an explanation and a very detailed go-through of the bill, I'd ask that you yield to Senator Scott.
Yeah.
Senator Scott, you have a small mic.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 64, the most recent UCC Title 1, Title 7 revisions. The bill, it's a product of the Uniform Laws Commission, as are all the bills in this part of the statute, Uniform Commercial Code. And we're adopting these two, Article 1 and Article 7. My information is that on Article 1, all the other states have adopted it, except Georgia and Missouri, and on Article 7, it's everyone but three states. So we're coming in relatively late in this. And members of the Senate, it is important because these transactions, commercial transactions, need to be uniform across these United States. It is important that we do adopt this and keep up to date. Article 1 is, in part, it's sort of an index, a catch-all, defines the scope of the articles. There's a definition of good faith that's new that I call the attention of the attorneys in the body to page 6, line 43. You can find that. Article 7 has to do with the transfer title of commercial goods, and what it does is brings uniform commercial code into the new world of electronics, and where a lot of the way that we've done business has changed quite a bit. It still does allow for paper documents, but with electronics there are a number of things different, including some confusion as to there isn't generally a specific original. That Article 7 starts on page 24 at line 41. And I would call the Senate's attention to a provision at the back on page 66, line 41, section 7. This is a local provision the committee put in. It says the legislature requests that Wyoming Uniform Commercial Code Title 34.1 of the Wyoming Statutes be published with the current Uniform Law Commission official comments as necessary to reflect revisions made to the Wyoming Uniform Commercial Code. The testimony in interim committee was that that would be extremely valuable to the practitioners in this area. So we did make that request. And, Mr. Chairman, we also hope the Management Council will make sure that as this goes forwards and gets codified, that they use the same numbering system that's in the bill, that's in the uniform code, so that we're corresponding to all the other states. I would say that it is very important in this area that we stay uniform and not try to amend things. We had extensive testimony in the interim committee from a panel of pretty high-powered lawyers that practice in this area, and Professor Welly, who teaches property law at the University of Wyoming, and she took us through it in some detail, and if we'd have paid attention, we could hang our shingle out and practice, but it wouldn't be safe. But they really emphasized that it ought to be important. They even convinced me that it was not wise to remove a such that was in here. They want to be that uniform so that this stays uniform and we're in line with everybody else. And along that lines, Mr. Chairman, if anybody does amend it, and particularly if any of the attorneys in the body amend it, we have arranged for former Representative Heine Meyer, former representative and former member of the Uniform Law Commission, I'm told, we've arranged for his ghost to haunt anybody that does that. Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Question.
Are you ready for the question?
Yes, we are.
All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Cal Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 64, say aye. Who won't do? All those opposed, no. Motion carries. Do I give that to you then?
No.
Oh, okay.
There we go.
Okay. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 127. The reading clerk will now read House Bill 127.
House Bill number 127, Termination of Employment Wages, sponsored by Representative Larson. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Hicks, Meyer, Pappas, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Case.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I would move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill Number 127, Termination of Employment Wages. Mr. Chairman, there is a standing committee amendment I'd ask to be read in at this time.
House Bill Number 127, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 12.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 127, and for an explanation of the bill and to cover the Standing Committee Amendment, I would ask that you call on Senator Burns.
Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 127 comes to us from a former legislator who was here last term from up my way, up Sheridan way. And she has a placement service where she provides skilled placement for businesses and so forth. So she has a number of employees and works with a number of businesses that have employees. One of the problems she ran across and asked good representative from Lander down the hall and me to bring deals with when an employee terminates their employment. And under current statute, if they either quit or if they're fired, they have to leave, employer has to give them a paycheck within 5 days. And so the original bill said, well, if they're discharged from service, we would still give them their paycheck within 5 days. But if they voluntarily resign, let's wait until the next cycle, the payroll cycle. And we have more and more businesses that are outsourcing their payroll, some cases into other states. And the idea of having to pay somebody within the 5 days actually disrupts not only their payroll cycle, but it also ends up having tax consequences on a number of these businesses. So the original bill basically stated that when the person voluntarily resigns, they'll get their paycheck in the next payroll cycle. Well, in testimony in front of the Corporations Committee, it was pointed out, well, if somebody actually is fired, the business should actually be able to have that ability also. The thinking before was that, well, if a guy's fired, you want to give him his check and get him out of here and have as little to do with him as possible. But in a number of cases, again, where you've outsourced your payroll services, or you've got a large number of employees and you have a payroll department that works on a regular cycle, we decided to, the committee decided to add when the person is fired also. And, Mr. Chairman, that is what the Standing Committee Amendment does. It adds for those people who are fired from service, they don't have to get their check any later than the regular payroll cycle. Now, this does not in any way stop the employer from paying the person before the next cycle if they so choose. In some cases, you'll have small businesses where it's just as easy to go ahead and write the check. In other cases, you still have the case where you don't want anything more to do with the person and you want to get them their check as soon as possible and get them out of there. So, with Mr. Chairman, I would the Standing Committee Amendment's been moved, and so I would entertain a vote on that or any questions on that.
Any question on the Standing Committee Amendment?
Aye.
Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 127, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Motion carries on the amendment. Number 1. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, during testimony on the bill, one of the other things we found out was that the vast majority of businesses in the state aren't aware of this statute. And in most cases, they are going ahead and paying their terminated employees over the regular payroll cycle, not realizing that the statute currently says within 5 business days. So since the statute is being violated as a matter of term, as a matter of course, without businesses knowing it, I decided to bring in the Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1, which is to make this act effective immediately upon signature. And with that, I would ask that the Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to House Bill 27 be read in.
House Bill 127, Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1, page 2, line 14.
Mr. Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to House Bill 27 and would be glad to answer any questions on that amendment.
Any questions on the Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1?
Question.
Question being called for. Those in favor of Senator Burns' motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment, or excuse me, the Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to House Bill 127, please say aye. All opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Back on the bill. Question on the bill. The motion is to adopt House Bill 127. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. House Bill 127 passes the Senate. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 45. The reading clerk will now read in the House Bill 45.
House Bill 45, Health Care Sharing Ministry, sponsored by Representative Barlow. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Meyer, Pappas, and Scott. No, Senator Case. Excuse, Senator Hicks. Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 45, Health Care Sharing Ministry. And for an explanation of the bill, I'd yield to the bill's co-sponsor, Senator Peterson.
I will.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bring to you House Bill 45. There's a lot of drivers in our healthcare industry right now with the ACA and other things that are happening. This is one of those things. In fact, this particular, I wasn't quite that familiar with sharing ministries, healthcare groups, but this was an interesting concept as I learned more about it. This bill is just basically excluding health care sharing ministries from the provisions of the insurance code that we have here in the state. The meat of the bill is on pages 2 and 3. Starting on line 3, we try to define what these health care sharing ministries should consist of, some important criteria to be considered. And one is on line 3, faith-based. Two, on line 3, nonprofit. On line 6, the third is financial sharing. On line 11, the fourth is annual audits. And finally, the fifth is on line 15, a written disclaimer. And that written disclaimer would basically be starting on line 18, and this kind of explains the meat of the bill. The organization facilitating the sharing of medical expenses is not an insurance company, and neither its guidelines nor plan of operation is an insurance policy. Any assistance with your medical bills is completely voluntary. No other participant is compelled by law or otherwise to contribute toward your medical bills. Participation in the organization or a subscription to any of its documents shall not be considered to be health insurance. And what these groups are, to give you a little background, there are approximately, turn to it here, since 1990, about 300,000 members in the U.S. belong to some type of a group such as this. We have about 2,000 residents in Wyoming with four major groups within our state that participate in this type of an agreement. And that's all it is. It's a contract. It's an agreement between the group and the individuals, basically agreeing to the fact that there are some months that I might not have medical bills, and so my monthly, I don't want to call it a premium, but amount that I contribute to this fund would be donated to another family or another person that might need some medical assistance in paying off a hospital bill or a doctor's bill or something like that. Again, it's a contract. It all has to be agreed upon. And if the at the end, a person can terminate their membership in such a group. The bill goes on to read and closes out that every person is responsible for their own payments of their own medical bills. If the organization ceases to exist or ceases to facilitate the sharing of medical expenses. I can't tell you if these groups will be continued to grow, possibly, as a subsidy for these high medical costs and bills that people are getting. I've never belonged to a group such as this, but it seems like it might be a good option, a good idea, and 2,000 of our citizens are already members of such groups. That's the bill. That's the intent, is to exempt them from the insurance code, the provisions contained in the insurance code. They're not insurance companies, nothing of the sort. These are contracts between our citizens and these groups. So I'd ask for your aye vote on this and stand for any questions.
There is a standing committee amendment, number one. Would the clerk please read in the amendment?
House Bill number 45, standing committee amendment number one, page 3, line 3.
Mr. Peterson. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the standing committee amendment. Mr. Chairman, my recollection is this came from the insurance commissioner in committee. It's in the section that tells you this is a caveat emptor kind of a proposition, and you can see it says very clearly that it's not subject to the regulatory requirements or consumer protections of the insurance code. I think that's a wise thing to put in. This makes it very clear, and I would urge the Senate to adopt the standing committee amendments. Be happy to answer any questions on it.
Any questions on the standing committee amendment? Senator Peterson.
Certainly consider this a very friendly amendment and adds further clarification to the bill's intent.
Sensing you're ready for the question, all those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt the standing committee amendment number one to House Bill 45, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. The amendment carries. We're back to the main bill, House Bill 45. Is there any discussion? Senator Barnard.
Mr. Chairman, I just had a quick question about this. Do the people who work for this organization, are they paid a wage? And if they're paid a wage, is that a taxable wage, the city or county or federal taxes?
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, yes, as a general proposition, I believe so. Now, there are, and these things are limited in the IRS code. Is set so you can't have any new ones. There's three or four big ones, and they're almost certainly paying their people a wage. There's a number of smaller ones that are connected often with particular religious groups, some of the traditional Amish and that sort of thing, and they may well be, at least in good part, volunteers. The testimony was that the fee was in the vicinity of 30%, I believe, of the total monies that were collected, which is somewhat in line with what you'd expect from an insurance company. And they have a fairly complicated proposition in the larger ones of allocating who's going to be asked to pay for whose medical bills. And so there is a fair amount of administration with this. So you don't by and large escape from that, although I'm not sure it's uniform.
Further questions on House Bill 45? Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I have two lines of questions on this, and the first is, I don't understand how this isn't an insurance company. Effectively, even if it's a nonprofit company, I see that. But at the end of the day, insurance is basically accepting a broad distribution of revenue at a low level to spread risk and then assume that risk. And then when an event takes place, you pay out. I mean, that's the basic concept of an insurance entity. Now, we've sort of evolved that into some interesting business practices over the years where it doesn't quite work the way it was supposed to. I'm curious how this fundamentally isn't simply an insurance company that's working the way that it originally was supposed to, which I don't disapprove of. You know, nice work on that, but it still seems like insurance to me. That's the first line. The second is, if we're going to do this, this is a health insurance cooperative, a nonprofit health insurance cooperative structure. I don't understand why it needs to be faith-based. I understand why you would want it to be 501c3. I understand why you would want it to be tax exempt, but I don't know why we have to have a faith-based underpinning for the corporate structure before you would be eligible for this statute. And I can understand having a statute like this for an insurance cooperative program, but if we're going to do that, shouldn't we have something in place for those who don't want it to be faith-based but simply want to share insurance premiums into a pool and then spread the risk based on that pool as per a traditional health insurance plan?
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that last issue, I certainly agree. It'd be nice if we could start some more of these up. I think they probably help a lot of different people. But the ACA Act only approved specific areas and specific existing organizations prior to a date, and I can't exactly remember when it was, but it was several years ago, 1999. So we can't do that. Whatever was in existence in 1999, we can do. After that, we can't. And essentially, from our understanding, is that those were the faith-based ones that were up and going at that time. So there may or may not be some out there that aren't faith-based before 99, but the major ones that take, you know, most of the customers were before that date.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the first part of that question, how it differs from insurance, this is all voluntary. And I know some insurance companies, it might seem that are voluntary too with their payments, but any assistance with your medical bills is completely voluntary. And I don't know, I'm not a member of a group such as this, but maybe my monthly contracted amount is voluntary as well. I mean, maybe some months I might be able to pay, other months I might not. So there's some major differences between insurance companies and this agreement between this group and the payments received. It's all voluntary, and it's again exempt under the ACA. To me, Mr. Chairman, it's something that the cost of medical bills, the ACA, all the moving parts that we're talking about with healthcare in our world today. Here we have a result. I think it's a workable solution, and we shouldn't be treating them as insurance companies because they're simply not.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, in testimony in committee, we did hear that indeed they are not insurance companies because the payment that they make is strictly for administrative purposes. The payment that when you join this faith-based, what are we calling them? Healthcare ministries. The payment is for administrative reasons. In other words, they have to keep track of all the folks that are on it, and they do distribute the requests for help. But when you get a request for help, you do not pay the organization for that request. Say you had a medical bill. The organization would put out a request in your name that you needed help. The check would actually be written from all the other people directly to you, not to the company. So it's really not insurance. It's almost a reimbursable type thing. It's a request for help. The company facilitates the request for help, and then you pay it. But the payment is voluntary. You don't have to pay it if you don't want. It's strictly voluntary. I'm not sure how they actually run. I would think that there might be a lot of folks that may not pay it if they're in dire straits for that particular month, or But the whole idea is to be able to help your neighbor. It's everybody in the group is helping everybody in the group. So it is not insurance. And the whole idea for even having this bill is so that they are not regulated by the state as an insurance company.
Senator Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, how do you become a member of this organization, and what standards are applied to determine whether your desire to be a member falls within this faith-based ministry organization?
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure that I can answer that. I think the testimony in committee is that membership is open. You can join these organizations. You probably have to perhaps suggest that you submit to their principles in a general sense, and you can become a member. Some of these are quite large, thousands and thousands of members. I found that very interesting. With respect to the exception in the law, it goes in a section of the law where these other things that are not required by the insurance code are farm mutual property insurance. Number two is fraternal benefit societies. And if you all recall, you may not know this, but most of our lodges started out originally as providing some form of insurance-like support to the members. They provided benefits, including health and survivor benefits to the spouse. You know, this would be like the Woodsman and the Elks, all these other things. Shouldn't use proper nouns, sorry. But so this kind of fits in that area. But I was a no vote only because I'm a bit uncomfortable with it being, faith-based. I agree with the good senator from Laramie that why couldn't this be open to anyone that wants to, to form an association to do this. But the testimony in committee was that this is a specific exception that's recognized both in the ACA and the IRS code. So if we were to form a mutual benefit society, we might have a hard time getting that same recognition from the ACA and the code. So that's why the faith-based is important. I'd really like to see it be more neutral on that issue. Mr. Chairman, there was testimony in committee that we don't that the insurance commissioner is not necessarily trying to regulate this activity, and that perhaps there's not even a need for the bill in that sense. It's not that this is under attack or under danger of being regulated in Wyoming. It's sort of a preemptive strike to make sure that they're not regulated, but I don't see the problem.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, from my point of view, I can see why they don't want clearly to be out from under the insurance code, and the insurance commissioners don't want to have anything to do with regulating them both. But I think the disclaimer is very important, and that's an important part of consumer protection here. You're telling people very clearly this is not an insurance thing. You can't get the protections you get with insurance. You're getting into this on a caveat emptor basis. I think you'll find that it's mostly, Mr. Chairman, used in religious communities where they feel they can depend on their co-religionists to live up to their moral obligations, and that's all it is, a moral obligation, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ruffus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious about the structure. I heard that there was an upfront payment, and then everything after that is optional. But as I'm investigating it, it looks like they have monthly sharing rates between, say, $50 and $400 a month, and then it's based on the number of family members and the age. And I don't understand how those two pieces of information can be internally consistent, where they have an upfront cost and then everything else is optional, but they have a required monthly fee. So I'm failing to understand once again how this isn't basically an insurance. I do now understand that it's the IRS and the ACA that are precluding the possibility of a cooperative structure. I'm still not convinced, though, that we should have a special carve-out for religious organizations to exempt themselves from the ACA and do what is effectively their own insurance program that is less regulated or entirely unregulated by the insurance commissioner.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. The reason why it's not insurance is the payments, the monthly payments, are only for administrative costs. There is no medical, the payments are not for medical treatment. So nothing that gets paid from the organization, they don't pay for medical treatment of any of their members. They collect money on a monthly basis for administrative costs to administer whatever they need to administer, the list and to be able to notify their members of the need. But the actual medical costs are paid directly from one member to another member on a voluntary basis. So it is not insurance.
Senator Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regards to this organization, I imagine it's probably registered with the Secretary of State. And if so, how are the board of directors selected, and how are they reimbursed for their administrative duties?
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I wish I could answer that, but I can't. These are, in a large part, faith-based, nonprofit, voluntary, neighbors helping neighbors. We're making this more than it actually is. There's four major organizations in Wyoming presently. Out of those four organizations, I would guess, Mr. Chairman, that they're all organized differently. That they're, we don't want to call it a premium, but their assessment to help contribute to that office, whoever sends out the notices that a member is in need, has a $10,000 hospital bill, could you please contribute something? I send a $10 check in the mail, and that's my participation that month for that person. I mean, that's basically what we're talking about. Or I could send a $10,000 check, pay it completely for that person. Neighbor helping neighbor, it's not insurance. And as the good senator from Lander suggested, it's just trying to get ahead of the game and making sure it's already in the ACA and exemption, and these groups have been around for a while, and it's I think it's a great idea, and ask for your favorable consideration on the bill.
Senator Rothfuss.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I understand that everything is theoretically optional, but as I'm looking at plans in front of me, two compared plans, it is laid out entirely like an insurance plan, except rather than using the word premium, it is using the word sharing. You have a monthly sharing obligation on some of these plans for singles, $21 to $393, couples, $33 to $594. This is per month. Families, $109 to $760. You have a maximum out of pocket prior to sharing beginning for you. And then after sharing begins, those funds are directed and funneled at you. So I think the key difference is that there's no holding of the money. So you don't actually have to act as a cash transmitter, but there is a centralized direction of where the funds go. So it's the same effect as an insurance company, but by cutting themselves out as a middleman and only accepting fees for the administrative side of it, they have basically circumvented the definition of what an insurance company is and done it in a very effective way. But at the end of the day, it is exactly what an insurance company is. You've got maximum lifetime coverage limits. You've got emergency room copays. You've got member office visit copays. everything that I'm looking at for how this is structured is exactly like an insurance policy, except for the fact that we don't use the word premium, we use sharing. So I understand that it's very well crafted in a manner that makes it not by the letter of the law an insurance policy, Mr. Chairman, by the spirit of the law and by exactly how they designed it as a cost distribution spread of risk approach to handling health care, it's an insurance policy. And I'm not comfortable with us carving that out, exempting them, and then taking them off of the obligations of the ACA to do that. Maybe others are, but it's clever, though. I like it.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, let me see if we can be crystal clear on this. Big differences between this and insurance company. This outfit, an insurance company, you take in premiums, you carry reserves to be able to pay claims. This does not do that. There are no reserves. You're at the mercy of the other members paying their suggested assessment, and it was very clear that that's not a legal obligation to the other members. I'm sure they'll kick you out. And they may, being faith-based, they may make some allowances for people that have hard times. And there was testimony about a particular member that belonged to one of these, and when he had his accident and he was the recipient, he then didn't have to pay these assessments for others for a number of months because he wasn't able to. He had too much of a misfortune to be able to do that, and they knew it. So it really is very different in that respect.
Senator Rothfuss, I don't know how much longer I can go pushing these buttons.
Mr. Chairman, the mouse is handy that way. Mr. Chairman, on that point, to be an insurance company, you don't have to. It's not a requirement that you have reserves. It's not a requirement that you use actuarial tables and do calculations. It's sound business that you do that. But if you operate on a cash basis, from a legal standpoint, it might be a requirement in Wyoming statute. But an insurance entity does not necessarily, by definition, by traditional historical definition, have to carry reserves. There are broad examples historically of how insurance works, and it can be a distribution of resources. You don't necessarily have to use the actuarial tables. That's how you do it if you want good business. That's how we do it typically in this country. But there's no definitional requirement that insurance operate in that fashion.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I beg to differ. You don't have adequate reserves. The commissioner puts you out of business if you're an insurance company. And that's true right across the country. It's a good part of what insurance regulation in this country is all about, what the National Association of Insurance Commissioners is all about to get that uniform. You have to have reserves, and they have to be adequate. And if they start to get inadequate, there's all kinds of remedies that the statute prescribes that we take.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And frankly, the insurance commissioner testified at our committee meeting that they indeed are not insurance companies and they don't want to regulate them as insurance companies. And frankly, that's all this bill does. And the testimony from the commission is that that's the way it should be. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, I think I've heard enough to think that a consumer could be confused. When you look at the pitches made by these organizations, a consumer could be confused by this. You know, not understand all the subtleties about how it works and might think they have more protection here than they indeed have. I agree that probably many of them operate totally above board and their members are very, very happy. But if you look at the literature that's on the web about these things, it can be very confusing, as the good senator from Laramie indicated. It looks a lot like insurance to me. And Lord knows that is a problem. When we, just this session, I had someone who bought insurance from a regulated company, assuming it was coverage that was worth something, and it wasn't when push came to shove. It's totally inadequate. That was a regulated product, and he still was burned by it. If this is totally unregulated, people don't understand insurance that well. I would suggest that, you know, there was no testimony that this is a problem right now or that we needed to carve out anything or that it was being overregulated in Wyoming. I'm not sure we should carve out this exception without further look at it.
Senator Esquivel.
Just one more time, Mr. Chairman. I guess the concern that I have is that last sentence on page 3. It says you are also responsible for payment of your medical bills if the organization ceases to exist or ceases to facilitate the sharing of medical expenses. You know, so that would certainly throw a yellow flag. You know, it still says whatever the medical expenses are, you're still responsible for them if the organization ceases to exist. You know, so there's no guarantee how long it's going to exist. But anyway, you see my point. Thank you.
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, one more time. The disclaimer is very important. And it explains pretty much the whole feed of this bill.
It's on.
Is it on? No.
It's on. You got to get closer.
No, it's not on. Light's not on.
Oh,
there I am.
Ray Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Matt Peterson. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Once again, Section C, the disclaimer, written disclaimer. I mean, I find it hard to believe that people that are in these organizations would fall into the trap of thinking that this was health insurance and that their $10,000 operation or $20,000 operation is completely covered. When you have a disclaimer like this and understand that it says any assistance with your medical bills is completely voluntary. No other participant is compelled by law or otherwise to continue toward your medical bills. Participation in the organization or a subscription to any of its documents shall not be considered to be health insurance. I mean, I don't know how much more plain it can be made on this disclaimer. I think the people are fully aware of what's going on and possibly would use this maybe as a supplement. Because we know that health insurance doesn't cover full expenses a lot of times. We don't meet our deductibles, and you're on your own. It's a great option, Mr. Chairman. It's a solution, free market. It's a great idea. And, again, I'd ask your favorable consideration on this bill.
Are you ready for the question? Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, look one of these up. It talks about the proper name assists members with prescription costs as follows. A gold lever member is incident-related prescription costs are eligible for sharing. Silver and bronze members, all programs, and it talks about premiums. It doesn't use the term premiums, but says that you have this coverage. It uses all the words as synonyms to what we would have for insurance. I could easily see how someone could be confused by this.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 45, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
House Bill 45 passes. Division. Division has been called for. All those in favor of House Bill 45, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. Please rise. House Bill 45 passes 16 to 9. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 108.
House Bill number 108, Trespass Landowner Liability, sponsored by Representative Miller. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals Business Economic Development. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28, Cole, Cooper, Rothfuss, Von Flateren, Senator Von Flateren, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Von Flateren.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a do pass recommendation on House Bill 108, Trespass Landowner Liability. And to explain this bill, I'd ask the chair to call on Senator Hicks.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the body, this brings in the Trespassers Landowner Liability Bill. It comes into Title 34, which is Properties and Security Transects. Carves out four more statutes in here. Specifies the duty of care for landowner owes to a trespasser. New sections 201 through 204. Let me go through those. 201 brings in definitions under the bill. Three new definitions under here. Land, which is a broad common term and used in context of this bill, means all open land and structures appurtenant to that land, and also goes as far as property, residential property within a incorporated boundaries of a city, town, or boundary. So, for all practical, all land is included. Owner means the owner of an interest in land, a tenant, a lessee, or renter, or some person that has control. Trespasser is a term that's used in here that's a common term for trespasser. Means a person, or enters or remains upon the land in the possession of another without the privilege to do so created by the owner's consent. Now get to the meat of the bill. Under Section 202, Duty of the Landowner, a new section in here, says the owner of the land owns no duty to a trespasser that, and is not liable for any injury to the trespass. Here's the exceptions. The exceptions are the owner owes a duty not to willfully and wantonly injure a trespasser. That's kind of been the existing standard as law exists today within the state of Wyoming. Members of the body, if you flip over on the next page, it brings in Section 203, which is artificial conditions highly dangerous to trespassing children. It says an owner of the land is subject to liability for physical harm to a child trespassing on the land caused by artificial conditions if, I'm going to go through this, Romanette I, is the, if the landowner knows or has reason to know that a child is likely to trespass. Romanette II, if a landowner realizes or should realize it will involve an unreasonable risk or death or seriously bodily injury to a child. Romanette III deals with children that are very young, so a child, because of his youth, and the landowner discovers that the condition or realizes there's a risk involved, that child that doesn't understand those issues coming within an area may be dangerous on that land. As used, up, I need to flip the page here. Mr. Chairman, as we go over to page 4, says if a landowner is burdened, there's very little burden and eliminate the danger to the trespasser, to a child. Romanette 5, if the owner fails to exercise reasonable care to eliminate the danger or otherwise protect the child. Members of the body, that sounds like a pretty comprehensive list, but let me tell you where that comes from. Where that section comes from is right out of here. It preserves the nuisance doctrine adopted by the Wyoming Supreme Court in the second reinstatement of torts. So that's as the laws exist today based on that Supreme Court adoption of that doctrine. So that's as the law exists today in the state of Wyoming. Members of the committee, we just go down to Section 204, just defines conflicts. If you go there, it says other standard or duty of care shall control over the provisions of this article. There's a couple provisions already in state statutes. One of them that we may be familiar with would be game and fish trespass. In that particular case, that would rule over this particular doctrine. So let me explain the need for the bill, members of the body. You should have a handout on top of your desk that says trespassers' responsibility laws to freeze land possessor's duty. If you'll pull that out and take a look at that. Let me explain the need for the bill. right now, what we're trying to do with this bill is freeze what has been existing law adopted through the Supreme Court or existing circumstances or case law in the state of Wyoming. These are the two provisions that we're adopting into the list law. These are consistent with the second reinstatement of the common laws. What's happened is, and the need for this, is there's now been a third reinstatement, and some courts are starting to adopt this. Within that third reinstatement, it takes a radical departure from what we would normally consider in Wyoming, and as you can see, and 16 other states have recently adopted this in the last 3 years. It takes a radical departure depending on what the longstanding approach was as to what a landowner's duty was. The third reinstatement vastly expands those, that includes all entrants in their land, including invading and habitual trespassers. So what we've effectively trying to do this is just codify the existing practices within the state of Wyoming. We adopt what the Supreme Court has said is the duty to a trust or duty of a landowner for children, and what your responsibility is you can't wantonly or willfully injure somebody that you know is trespassing on your property. Third provision is this, then, when we bring in Section 203, the intent there, that's the preserve the existing nuisance doctrine adopted by the Wyoming Supreme Court. I think we've gone through the rest of the bill. Mr. Chairman, I would stand for any questions.
Any questions? Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, in many respects, the statute that you have is an attempt to codify existing law and say that's going to be the law forever. And there makes some merit to that, and it's a difficult proposition for the following reason. First of all, this comes from what we call the restatement of law second. And Wyoming has generally adopted the restatement of law second, and it's pretty good law. Now, there are people that go in, there are a group of folks that update these restatements, and they've gone out and created what's called the restatement third. The restatement third has not been adopted by very many states, but it generally says it's a duty of ordinary care owed to everybody, and there's some exceptions. I don't think any attorney practicing in Wyoming at this time it really believes that the restatement of third is appropriate for Wyoming. And so the first thing on the table is the restatement second really ought to be the law of Wyoming. It ought to stay the way of law of Wyoming, and the courts have no business changing it. But the courts wouldn't, because in Wyoming right now, the restatement second controls. Now, here's the difficulty with this, and that is this language is verbatim language out of a Wyoming case, but it's a Wyoming case that addresses children. And this is an accurate statement of law with respect to the duty to willful wanton damage. That would actually be the case for trespassing, because you can't, no matter, even if you own the land, you can't, and the cases that you think of that you've read in the past is trap guns. You can't put a trap, if you know people are going to come onto your property, you can't set up a shotgun so when they open the door, something like that. That's willful and wanton. That's the easy case. If you know people are reasonably likely to come in and trespass, you can't set up booby traps for them, things like that. That's willful and wanton. But here's an area of law that right now would create liability that may be eliminated by the adoption of this, and it's a theory of law that's available under the restatement second, which would be the current law. Suppose you have a piece of property, you're in town or out of town, doesn't make any difference. And suppose you know that every day people trespass on your property to go fishing, or it might be it's just the way your property lays out. Everybody walks through your yard, and let's say you got an awning there, and every day people are using that awning, you know, and they don't have your permission, they're trespassing. And you may have even told them, look, I wish you would walk around my house and not go into the awning. And then suppose you
you're looking at your awning, you look up, and you realize that the beam is rotted through. And you think to yourself, you know, I better fix that beam. You know there are trespassers there. And you don't intend to hurt them. You just fail to take action, and the trespasser comes through, which you know he's doing. The beam falls down and crushes him. So under the current restatement, which is being is that the law would be, if the possessor knows or from facts known as knowledge should know that there's a dangerous proximity to an artificial condition. That's what this is. The beam is an artificial. You built it. It's yours. And the condition is such that the you have reason to believe that the trespasser will not discover the risk. And you know that because the trespasser is going to walk under that beam. Unlikely he's going to leap there. Maybe the beam is above and you look and says, I could see this thing is going to fall down any day now. And you just choose not to act. So you could put a barricade up there and say, stay out. Beam there, you could take it down, or you could go to the trespasser and say, look, don't do this. You can imagine people, you know, on our family ranch, we know that there are regular trespassers going to certain areas to go fishing. We don't like it. We don't give them permission for it. But we never really took the step. But suppose you pull your tractor through and you create a hole. And a board falls on it. Something happens and you kind of know that's dangerous. Well, if you know if there's no trespassers, you don't worry about it. But if you know that public's going through there, you probably have some obligation to make sure that they don't fall through a hole. I mean, if you put a piece of paper over them and you don't attend to it, but you think, paper's not a good example, but you do something artificially to it, thinking that you'll get to it later, and you're thinking, well, I don't care about the trespassers. Well, that's not willful and wanton misconduct. So, in this case, the difficulty that the supporters of this bill have had is if you want to go and adopt the restatements, there's about 8 or 9 sections. It's not that difficult, but you either have to restate them in whole, or if you begin to pick and choose, you're not going to pick up something. So first of all, I concur that the restatement second should be the law, is the law. The language that is pulled out, though, is the law generally as it applies to children. And there is one more exception that's being missed. And my guess is you could think of circumstances where you say, you know, if you know you've got people walking under your awning and you know that it's about ready to collapse and people couldn't see it, you probably have some duty to take some action even though you know they're trespassers. Even though it's not willful and wanton misconduct. I didn't intend to hurt them. I just didn't take the action. So, you know, I don't think we've quite gotten there. I do think that we're getting closer than prior bills. But I just throw that out for your consideration.
Senator Kinski.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. When we were young, I and my two little brothers and some of the neighborhood kids got tired of going the long way around to the fishing hole. So we cut across this rancher's field. We were about halfway, and I hear a window crack open. The rancher's wife opens the window, and she says exactly the right thing. She yells out, "You little boys, watch out for those rattlesnakes in that field." I don't know if there are any rattlesnakes in that field, but that's the last time we cut across it. These trespassing cases involve children, and it's important that this bill makes that exception for children. But it's also important to understand that this bill preserves a hallowed aspect of American law that hails from the common law. And that is that there's a difference between somebody who is on your land without your permission and somebody you invited upon your land. So somebody you invited is an invitee. So the classic case is somebody's in the supermarket in the produce aisle, there's a banana or there's produce on the floor, they slip, they fall, they sustain an injury, and the courts say in those instances, in all such instances, you owe a duty of reasonable care under the circumstances to that person. With respect to trespassers, it's different. Hailing back to the spring gun or the trap gun cases, it says that you must refrain from any willful and wanton action. There's a trend in American law to eradicate the distinction between an invitee and a trespasser and just say you owe the same duty to everybody, whether they're a trespasser or whether you invited them on your land. And this bill seeks to arrest that slippery slope and say, no, there is a meaningful distinction between trespass and a business invitee in Wyoming, where there is so much land that can be trespassed upon. So when I was older than when I was going across the field, but still a young man during my brief foray into the practice of law, I was asked to work on a case that was a lawsuit against a client that had a closed gasoline station on Main Street in Sheridan, Wyoming. And it clearly was closed, and it clearly was posted. No trespassing. Well, these folks decided to use it as a turnaround while they were buzzing Maine. And their front wheel went through the lid to the gasoline tanks had become dislodged, and their front wheel went down into it, and their teeth came up against the steering wheel. And they sued our client for trespass, for liability for those damages. Now, I was young enough and naive enough that I thought, now, how can a trespasser possibly sue a property owner under these circumstances, given that there was nothing willful and wanton? And, in fact, the Supreme Court upheld that rule. But then the cases continue, and they continue, and they continue. Now you get to the tougher cases. It was a case in Casper. Two little boys drowned in a pond. The grieving parents sued the rancher. You should have fenced out that pond. The Supreme Court said it's a natural condition. It's not that they were trespassers, but we're not going to find liability in that situation. But then there have been subsequent situations, and again, I believe it was in a Casper case, where the little kids getting into a house that was under, it was an old house being fixed up, and there was paint and turpentine. And they got into the paint, tried to remove it with the turpentine. There was a spark, and you can imagine what happened. You can't tell those little kids there's no relief for them, particularly when there was evidence that the owner knew that people were coming and going out of this building. So that's a distinction that needs to be preserved, and that's a distinction that this bill does preserve. An artificial condition, attractive to children. You had reason to know they'd be trespassing. It seems reasonable, and you could have easily fixed it. You could have sealed the paint cans, removed the turpentine. It seems reasonable under those circumstances to say, trespasser or not, you've got some liability on you. So that's the whole essence of what this bill is to say we want to preserve the status of the law in Wyoming as it is now, and we want to stop the slide, as we've seen in some more liberal jurisdictions, where it says, trespasser or not, an adult, you owe them the exact same duty as somebody you invited into your business. The standard is reasonable. It's been upheld in Wyoming law. We've heard talk about restatement second, restatement third. The problem with the so-called restatement third and second and first is when I was a young man, restatements would try to say this is what the law is as we see it in a jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction basis. That's morphed over time to where you see restatements not restating, but instating, saying this is what we want the law to be. And that's what we've got to avoid in Wyoming, is that slippery slope, and we need to draw a clear, bright line for the Supreme Court and for property owners and for ranchers and for farmers as to what the limits of liability are, so that these things can be more predictable and so that they can obtain the proper and necessary insurance for their businesses. I urge your considered support of HB 108. Thank you.
Question.
Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Von Flattern's motion that when the committee as a whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 108, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 108 passes. Pass the committee of the whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 121. Will the reading clerk read the bill?
House Bill number 121, Article 5, Convention Limitations, sponsored by Representative Larson. It was referred to Committee number 12, Rules and Procedures, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Nicholas, and Perkins. No, Senator Kraft and Rothfuss. Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Bebout. No. Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee of the whole rise the report to do so with a favorable recommendation with respect to House Bill number 121, and for an explanation of the bill, I turn it over to Senator Bebout.
Senator Bebout.
There is an amendment, Mr. Chairman. I would ask it to be read in at this time.
House Bill number 121, Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to engross copy, page 3 after line 13.
Mr. Chairman, there's one nice thing about having your name start with B, that it shows up on the bill before all the others. But actually, there's been another gentleman who happens to have a name that starts with W that's worked on this. So I'm going to turn this over to Senator Wasserberger.
Senator Wasserberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me attempt to walk you through this bill. This bill actually sets regulations for an Article 5 convention. And so let's look at the amendment which has been moved. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wasserberger. Senator Wasserberger, it has been read in. It wasn't moved yet.
Okay, I would like to move Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 121, and I would like to discuss it at this time. Essentially what it does, on page 3, line after line 13, it inserts any voting delegate shall be directed to vote for procedures and rules mandating that the convention remain a convention of the states where each state is represented by one vote. And there's been considerable discussion about a Article 5 convention and the possibility that it could be by proportional representation. It is actually my opinion that an Article 5 convention would be by the states, and it would be the delegation within the state, and each state would have one vote. So what this does is essentially say that the delegates have to have one vote, one state. And then it deletes page 3, line 15, and it inserts C and then D and then all the way down. And then finally, on page 4, after line 17, the number and identity of the delegates representing the state of Wyoming shall be selected by the Management Council of the Wyoming Legislature in consultation with the governor. And essentially what this does, if there ever is an Article 5 convention called, Management Council, in the absence of the legislature, would name the delegation. And they would consult with the governor as to who that would be. And it would be my opinion that we would pick our best. And we would send our best to this convention. Other questions? And so, Mr. Chairman, I would ask for your favorable support on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Ready for the question? Question, all those in favor of Senator Wasserberger's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 121, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. That amendment has passed. We are now on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are back on the bill. Essentially what the bill does is it sets up how an Article 5 convention would be called by the people of, actually, this legislature. And we do have a House joint resolution coming here in just a few minutes. Never in the history of the United States has an Article 5 convention been called. But we do set in place a basic structure in case one ever is called for future leaders of the state of Wyoming. And that's essentially what the bill does, and I stand for questions at this time.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I've been looking at Article 5 in the U.S. Constitution, and it says the Congress, on application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments, which shall be, in either case, valid to all intents and purposes part of this Constitution when ratified, etc. Mr. Chairman, this legislation that's before us, that's a statement of how we'd like to see the world. But I would suggest to the legislature that if the Congress in its call provides something different, that's likely to govern, and this legislation won't do any good. I'm powerfully afraid this is a feel-good piece. It's designed to make us feel more comfortable about calls for an Article 5 convention. But I don't see how, if they provide something different than what we want in that call, and they will provide, I know they'll provide some things in that call. They'll say when and where and that sort of thing. They'll probably say how many delegates. If they provide something we don't like, I don't think that we're likely to be able to prevail over a call from the Congress. So I really caution the members, probably relatively harmless to pass it, as long as you don't believe it, because it's not likely to prevail if the Congress does something different.
Mr. President.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, as you see, all of the Article 5, we had a variety of bills were assigned to the Rules Committee. I've been working on this the last couple of weeks, struggling. For me, this is one of the hardest potential votes that we have this session. The reason I say that is because we sit here, we're a population of under 600,000 people. Our largest revenue source is from federal mineral royalties. And we see constantly that every time there's a balanced budget restriction, if a member of Congress is looking to pay for a favorite program, they look for cash. And the cash is from our federal mineral royalties, and we continue to see an assault on our funds. And what causes me not to sleep at night is thinking that in our haste to call a convention, that we inadvertently create a circumstances where the very next day we lose our federal mineral royalties, our PILT dollars, on our Mount of Mine land funds, and we have no place to go. And the federal government still owns over 40% of our state, so we don't have the capacity to generate economic wealth because so much of our state is withdrawn from economic development. So there are two issues that we have to talk about. But in general, it would have been better if these bills were in a different order, but they are in the order that they're presented. The bill before you is not a call for a convention, and it does not provide any protection for what could happen in a convention. What it does say that if there is a call for Article 5 convention, whether it's we are part of the member states, 34 states, I think, is that that call for the convention, or whether we're not part of it, you still, if it is called, you'd need to have some capacity to determine how are you going to select delegates, how many delegates do you send, and what can those delegates do once they get there? Can you constrain your delegates to vote in a certain way? So with respect to this statute, it addresses that issue because it's not in our existing statute, so I'd urge your support of this. But there are a couple things that we say in the statute. First of all, we say Management Council will select a number of delegates. Then we say when you arrive at the convention, you're required to vote consistent with our legislation or any call that we've issued. Our colleague from Casper says it exactly right, because here's kind of what I think I'm not a constitutional expert, but I believe this is my assessment of the law. This is the way it works. You have advocates out there, by the way, that advocate their constitutional view. So part of it is trying to sift through where the advocates argue and where there's pretty clear line. It appears that constitutional experts seem to agree that in a call for the convention, that a state can call for a specific subject matter, and that's all that call would be good for. So if 34 states called for a convention only to address the Article 5 amendment, all they want to do is discuss the balanced budget convention, that would be the limit of the subject matter. But then at that point, Congress has the obligation to call the Constitution, pull everybody together, and say it's going to happen in Philadelphia on this date at this time. The rules of the convention get established by everybody as they arrive. That first vote will be one state, one vote. One state, one vote on the very first vote, and that is, what are your rules? But if at the time arriving, more than 50% of the states say, we think that we ought to be govern ourselves by the Electoral College system, that then becomes the rule of the convention. Now, the assumption is that 51 states will never ask to have representation except one state, one. I've met 51% of the states. Thank you. So the assumption is that 51% of the states will say, we like the one man, one vote. But there's no guarantees. So there's a couple approaches that people have established to try to figure out how to deal with this. One is that there's an effort out there to have the states enter a contract so you get two-thirds of the states agreeing that when we arrive, we will conduct our affairs. It's only going to be one state, one vote. Now, you could have 10 delegates, but they can only cast one vote. And we want to only deal with these issues, and we want to do these. And so that's a compact. So there's a compact of states. You're all familiar. We have compacts out there. The only compact that was presented to us is a pretty complicated compact of recent origin, and the majority of folks just weren't comfortable with that.
But
And there's only two states that are looked at anyway. So you're a long ways away from having two-thirds of the states enter into a contract with each other that if we have a convention, this is how we're going to do it. This is how we're going to set up our rules. So then the question is should we call for the convention and under what terms and conditions? That topic is not part of this bill. That's in the next bill, the House Joint Resolution, that we'll talk about separately. This bill simply says if under some circumstances there is an Article 5 call that's valid, this is how we're going to select our delegates, and we want them to be restricted. And one of the things we just pointed out is they're required to, when they arrive, to vote that states be represented one vote at one time. But that's just a mandate for your one vote on that first vote. It doesn't protect you from the scope or anything like that, and this is not intended to do this. So the discussion with respect to this bill and on and for this bill is simply to have a statutory structure in place so that if this event takes place, there will be we'll have answered some of the questions that who appoints it. Is it the Democratic Party? Is it the Republican Party? Is it the governor? Is it just a group of people? We say it's the management council. We'll identify the persons and the numbers with consultation with the governor. And when they go, they're required to vote in certain ways. And if they fail to, they'll be guilty of crimes. So I'd urge you to vote for this just to set up that structure.
Senator Wasserberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to quickly take the body through how a convention works. And first of all, you have to have 34 states apply for the convention. The resolutions do not have to be the same in their wording, but only need to state the convention is limited to considering a certain amendment. Congress has already decided a convention can be called for a single subject. Over the past 150 years, Congress has received more than 500 applications from the states to convene a convention under Article 5. Upon receiving 34 applications on the same subject, Congress shall convene a convention. It has no discretion in the matter, and Congress must call the convention. Congress's only authority is to set the time and the place for the convention. It cannot interfere in any matter regarding the convention and how it will function or its representation. The next step in an Article 5 convention is for the states to select the delegates, and that's what this bill does. Since the assemblage is a convention of states, each state legislature will determine the following: how many delegates it will send, how many delegates will be chosen, what specific instructions the state will give its delegation, the conditions for recalling a delegate for violating the state's instructions or rules of the convention, and so forth. The next step is for the convention to meet and to propose the amendment. And how the convention will function is not a mystery. From the minutes of previous conventions of states, the rules and procedures can easily be created. The delegations will write the rules of the convention, voting by state, and the convention will deliberate the issue. After whatever single subject amendment they're determining at the time, ultimately that amendment goes back to Congress. And Congress has two choices at that point. It can have the amendment ratified by state legislatures or by ratifying conventions. They only have two choices. And then, at that point, 38 states must approve the amendment. So the bar is very high. And, Mr. Chairman, that's essentially the process for an Article 5 convention.
Discussion? Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just real quickly, regarding the amendment that we've already passed and the comments from our president, I just for clarification, we really only have that first vote, I assume. And then if that vote goes down, there's a distinct possibility that, that it would not be one vote, one state. It could very potentially be, you know, delegates, numbers, and we could be outnumbered pretty greatly. Is, am I understanding that process correctly?
Senator Hicks?
Mr. Chairman, if I can try to walk through that process, because it's like everything that our founder fathers did. They implemented a series of checks and balances. There's a reason that they put Article 5 in there and a call for the state's convention. And if you read Madison and Jefferson and Washington, they foresaw a time in our future where the federal government was going to get out of control. And they said the only way to get control and get back and the control of the Constitution was going to be through a convention of states. Like everything else our founders did, they provided a series of checks and balances through Article 5. So let's run through the scenarios that were described. There was a call, for a convention of states. 34 states come, single subject. Congress only sets the time and the date. That's pretty well established in the legal scholarship on Article 5. So we get there and the first vote is cast and it says one state, one vote. And that's shot down. Well, what's the checks and balances that the founders put in there? You have open debate. You have a discussion. And as the discussion goes along and after months and months of discussion, if you can't come out of that convention with something that 34 states agree to, you have nothing. You had a call of the states that sit and debated and debated and debated, and they left. But let's assume the other scenario and continue that farther. What's the other check and balance that the founders put in Article 5? So you have the convention. You have 34 states. Worst case scenario, 34 states send one thing out of there, and they say we're going to do it by delegates. What's the check that the founders put in there? The next check is it takes two-thirds majority, 38 states that they either have to ratify that or two-thirds of the majority of both houses of Congress. This is a very complicated and very difficult process to ever get, number one, 34 states to agree on anything, and number two, even if those 34 states to agree on it, it still has to be ratified by 38 states. The idea that we're going to have 38 states or even 34 states come up with something that's radically divergent for what the purpose of that call for is a bump in the night. The likelihood that it ever happens. But let me talk to the issue of what's at hand and why this is important. You have four amendments to the Constitution of the United States today that already are a result of Article 5, Convention of States. Were they the direct result? No, they were the byproduct. Because what has traditionally happened, when you get enough states, usually somewhere around 30, and Congress says, oh my God, them states are going to do it. They're going to have a convention. They're going to usurp Congress. Guess what happens? And if you go to our history, the 17th, the 21st, the 26th, or 22nd, and the 25th Amendment, are almost directly responsible because of a potential Article 5 states convention. And guess what? All of those were ratified, but they had to go back and get 38 states to ratify. One case, 38 states ratified that. The other cases, two-thirds of the majority of both the Senate and the House of Congress ratified those amendments. So I would tell you, when we start talking about the idea of these runaway conventions, the founders provided the remedy, and that's the checks and balances all the way through the process. So, members of the body, I would suggest that we move this one on. Let's get to the resolution and deal with that. But there is a remedy there. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion that the Committee of the Whole rises... rise to report and do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 121. Say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
That House Bill 121 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Senate Joint, or no, House Joint Resolution number 4.
Number 1.
Oh.
Should be 1.
That's what I heard. 62. I'm trying to take them in order like I was ordered to take them. But the next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 62. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
House Bill number 62, Property Tax Exemption for Religious Education Camp, sponsored by Representative Stubnow. It was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Kinsey, Landon, Peterson. No, Senator Case. Excuse, Senator Driscoll, Senator Peterson, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that when the committee of the whole rises report that it do so with favorable recommendation consideration on House Bill 62. And there is a standing committee amendment, and I'd ask for that to be read in at this time.
I don't have a 60.
Here's one here.
House Bill number 62, standing committee amendment number 1 to engrossed copy, page 2, line 5.
Mr.
Peterson.
Senator Peterson, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move standing committee amendment number 1 to House Bill 62 and ask for the body's favorable consideration on this amendment. This is on page 2, line 5, and we inserted after training associated fellowship activities. For the purpose of some of these religious camps having some other activities that make the camp somewhat more fun. We wanted to make sure that weddings, other events that might happen at these camps would also be included and considered. So that, with that, Mr. Chairman, I would stand for questions on the standing committee amendment. If not, I'd call for the question on the amendment.
Any questions on the amendment? Sensing that you're ready for the question, all those in favor of Senator Peterson's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 62, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. That amendment has passed. The motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment number 1, House Bill 62, has passed. Senator Peterson. Back on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For further explanation on this good bill, I'd turn the time over to Senator Anderson, O2.
Senator Anderson, O2.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not a long bill, and I'll attempt to keep it so. Act relating to the property exemptions on religious education camps for property taxation. This bill received quite a lot of discussion in committee from the Department of Revenue, and I think what to kind of characterize the nature of this bill is to bring definition to the process. And so if you'll look, the following at line 11 at the bottom of the page 1, the property is exempt from taxation. This then comes as an amendment to section 3911105. And it goes on to explain that the property that would be exempted under this is exclusively to be used exclusively for religious worship, church schools, and church parsonages. And B, for religious education camps, which are used exclusively for religious education training. And then this is where the amendment came in, associated fellowship activities, worship, and are not used for private property or for commercial purposes. The idea being, I think it tightens the definition. There was some discussion in regard to what exclusively means, and under the revenue code, under church property, section 7 of the revenue code, it says, the word exclusively shall not be construed so narrowly and literally that defeats the purpose of an exemption. Any use, however, other than qualifying as a religious worship under the statute must be de minimis or truly minor. As an example, the receipt of pay for temporary use of church property will not be needed or desired for religious services. And so it goes on and defined it that way. In talking with the Department of Revenue, it's not so narrowly defined that you could not use the camp for 4-H conservation, perhaps a wedding. What they're trying to avoid is those camps who might present themselves to the public for profit, perhaps to be used in the off-season for a hunting camp or for snowmobiling or other such things that might put themselves into competition with the private sector. And that, as I understand, has happened in the past. And so this, what I think this bill does, quite simply put, is provides more definitive guidelines for both sides so those camps know what they have to do in order to comply, and so the Department of Revenue knows what their responsibilities in regard to enforcement. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would pause for questions, and if there are in fact none, I would then call for the question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, just curious on this bill. Any idea how many of camps would qualify under this exemption around the state or in the state? How much money might be involved? And in fact, does this property tax exemption, how does this reflect on the various counties? Would they actually just end up losing the tax revenue from it, or is there some expectation that the state will backfill it?
As I understand it, most all the camps that we're talking about here would comply. And so those counties then would probably and most likely recognize these camps as being in existence now. I would call upon any of the revenue committee to correct me if I'm wrong in this, but I think statewide, collectively, the exemptions under this provision is somewhere around $900,000. Now, the thing, I think one of the things that prompted this bringing this bill forward, there was a camp, and I won't name the county, I don't think I should, but there was a camp that was actively advertising for hunters and other things like that. That then took them out of compliance, and the Department of Revenue challenged them on it, and they were then assessed. But that's the best information I have in regard to statewide, in regard to what these exemptions are.
Senator Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering if there was any discussion during the committee meetings as to how much property we were talking about. Was there any discussion on that? Because it seemed like it could vary quite tremendously. But anyway.
Senator Anderson.
I don't have that exact number. I think I could find that out. I would expect that you're asking in terms of acreage or in terms of assessment, some way to value or to quantify that. I could find that information out, but it did not come up in the conversation I was involved with.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I may be wrong on this, but I recall from the testimony in the Revenue Committee that the total amount of new property that might come under this would be about $900,000. And so, you know, when you work out the tax rate on that, that's not a lot of money. The problem with exemptions is once they're exempted, we don't know the value of that property. They're not, so we don't know what's already exempted. You don't assess property that's got that exemption. That's the way I recall the testimony, Mr. Chairman. And we can check it out further, but that it is $900,000 for additional property that will qualify for this exemption.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the fiscal note, on the white copy of the bill, it kind of defines a little bit about the $900,000 per year. $61,500 per year decrease is estimated based on the 2014 average statewide mill levy of 68.3 mil. So it kind of breaks it out. That's the amount that we're talking about. $10,800 of this revenue decreases from the 12 mil levy of the school foundation program. $27,900 of this revenue decreases from the 31 mils levy for K through 12 local resources, so on. So, but the acreage never was talked about in committee, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think my question was answered about the counties, whether the counties would take this hit to their revenue stream or whether they'd expect some sort of backfill from the state on it. And the other question I have about this is, once these camps receive the exemption, they cease being inspected, I assume, by the county assessor. What mechanism is in place to know when they might decide to start boarding hunters or something, especially if they're in the mountains?
Senator Anderson, 02.
I would just simply say that those are questions that did not come up in the committee conversation, and I will do all I can between now and second reading in order to investigate this in terms of counties and the other question that was posed. So perhaps a member of revenue might have a better answer than I.
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, I would say that the counties will take the hit on this, and there would be no backfill.
That's what exemptions do.
This is what exemption does, yes.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, the senator mentioned, I don't think his mic was on, but that the counties would be taking a hit on this, and there is no backfill. In answer to the question of what prevents someone from expanding their purpose, the testimony in committee about the event that actually did happen in a particular county in Wyoming is that the assessor determined that a camp was actually advertising on the Internet, reaching out to hunters and other potential users of the camp. So assessors around the state are kind of on patrol about shifting uses and whether it truly qualifies for the exemption. And I think they do a pretty good job at that overall. But, of course, you couldn't catch everything. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, one more question.
Senator Burns.
I'm kind of confused about that statement about a particular camp somewhere advertised some different purpose, and so they were found to be out of compliance. And I'm kind of confused because we haven't passed this bill yet. So were they already getting an exemption, and if so, how?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Case.
Yes, many facilities across Wyoming already get the exemption and are already kind of qualifying for it. Some aren't, some are. This makes it very clear. I didn't support the exemption, but this, I think, clarifies what that exemption should be, and different places are applying it differently. It really hinges on whether how much religious purpose it is. And, you know, in our laws, exemptions are provided for houses of worship, parochial schools, but not specifically for camps. And so we added the language about camps, but we also modified the language to allow that you could still have a little bit of fellowship with regard to the camp. A camp would be pretty boring if it was exclusively for religious purposes. I wouldn't even go to that camp.
hunting for God.
Senator Kinski.
Mr. Chairman, answer the other part of the question of my colleague from Sheridan. He asked about what was the fact pattern in the ones in this situation that drew the attention of the Department of Revenue. And it was not just a wedding here or there when the camp wouldn't be used for other purpose. It was their web page was given over to hunting camp. We've got restaurant. We've got lodging facilities. We've got come one, come all. And thanks to the vigilance of state employees and probably a tip from a few competitors, they were told that they're actually now wholly in the business, not just a camp with incidental additional uses, if that helps clarify.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Peterson's motion that the when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 62, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That bill passes. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 106. Would the reading clerk please read the bill? Yeah.
House Bill number 106, Non-Consensual Towing Services, sponsored by Representative Dave Zwanet, sir. It was referred to Committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, which reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, 02, Emmerich, Escobel, Johnson, and Meyer. Senator Meyer, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, it do so with a do-pass motion on non-consensual towing services. Mr. Chairman, this bill essentially is a codification of a lot of the rules and a lot of the things that the Highway Department does today. There's a couple things in there that are a little different. One of them we dealt with the Standing Committee as a Standing Committee amendment and removed it, and I'd ask that that be read in at this time.
House Bill 106, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 3, line 10.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, when we get to that spot in the bill for the amendment, we'll take it up. First of all, we say that by rule and regulation, the department's going to provide for safe and efficient removal of vehicles from highways when the owner or the operator of the vehicles is unable to actively assist in the vehicle's removal. Basically, can't make that phone call or doesn't have a number or however, or you ask for assistance and the department steps in. Now, what the department's going to do is establish a voluntary rotation list for tow trucks. And it's going to call, that's enrollment at 1, enrollment at 2. You have basic standards, and they're going to develop a rotational call. Enrollment at 3, you have procedures to be placed on the rotational call list. Number 4 gives you the minimum equipment standards for tow trucks. 5 is inspections of the carriers necessary to enforce the licensing requirements. 6 is identification of the areas where the tow truck's going to operate. This is where we go into the Standing Committee Amendment, Mr. Chairman. And what we do is delete on line 10, after reprimand and all of 11, and over to line 12 before suspension. And then down on line 20, we delete assessed penalty. And that's what we do. We take out the penalty, which was a $200 fine. And I'd stand for questions on the amendment. If there are no questions, I'd call for the question.
Did you move the amendment?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Questions on the amendment? Questions on the amendment? Hearing none, you're sensing you're ready for the question. All those in favor of Senator Meyer's motion to adopt Standing Committee 1, Amendment Number 1, to House Bill 106, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
That amendment has passed. The motion, the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 106 has passed. We're back on the bill.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, we end this bill on page 4. This is a little bit different on some of the things that the department has done in the past, but in part the same. There's a requirement that the tow truck recovery carrier file a summary rate of disclosure document. And that's going to contain the typical fees, call rates, hookup fees, winch fees, labor costs, mileage, storage costs, all of those things that go into the cost of a tow. Then it provides for on line 7 that any action, which would be a civil action, where fees are charged to a towing company is an issue, the burden of proof to show that the fee is fair and reasonable shall be upon the towing company. Now, realize, ladies and gentlemen, that the towing company already has the money. And kind of a necessity for this bill is the large deviation between almost identical towing services, where it could be midnight on the same stretch of road, the same wreck, essentially the same model of car. One towing company will take that car for $250. The next towing company is going to charge $2,500. So the department wanted to kind of get in there just a little bit, put some sideboards on there, go through and basically codify what they're doing now so the tow companies know that they're not playing favorites to anybody because it's in the statute. They've got to follow it. And really ask every one of them that wants to be on the tow list, what do you charge for most things? You know, I mean, it's going to vary because you got night, you got cold, you got weather, you got big trucks. There is one big truck. The testimony is that they charge $70,000 to tow a semi. You got me. That's a pretty steep fee. I don't know how rough that tow was, but it must have been a real rough tow, or somebody probably was paying too much money. So, Mr. Chairman, those are some of the things that we heard in testimony. That's kind of the reason for the bill, is to get some sideboards on this, and I'd ask for your favorable consideration.
Any discussion? Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just real quickly, at first blush, this is one of those pieces of legislation that you might think, well, why do we want to delve into private enterprise? A couple of things to think about and to understand what your Transportation Committee went through the last 2 years. We've been talking about this particular issue. Two things to think about. One is non-consensual. You might have a wreck out there on the highway. Two cars come together. You're injured. You've got to get to the hospital. You don't have any say whatsoever on what they're going to do with your car. That's what a non-consensual tow is. And maybe both cars can't be moved. And so you have two separate towing companies come out to get those cars. And lo and behold, a few weeks down the road, you're healed up, and you get the bill from the towing company. And your bill might be $1,200 to move that car for you. You find out that the other car, it cost about $300 with the other towing service to move that one. That's a quick and dirty explanation of what non-consensual tow is. And it can go all the way up to these big semis. Well, the association that runs those big trucks up and down the highway came to the Transportation Military Affairs Committee and said, isn't there something we can do about this massive deviation in the kind of bills that everybody's receiving here? Along with that, the insurance departments came as well, because what was happening was the insurance companies aren't going to cover that $1,200 tow. They're going to give you enough money to maybe get it towed for about $250. So people on these non-consensual tows were literally getting bent over, Mr. Chairman, and so that's what brings you this bill. And unfortunately, in the car, what is central, I think, to the bill is you find it on page 4, and that unfortunately comes about because there have been perhaps a couple of bad apples in this business that have created the black eye. So what this bill calls for, and I think it's reasonable. And that is just simply provide to the Department of Transportation reasonable fees, what you could expect to have to pay if you run off the road out there in Wyoming or get in a wreck. So I hope that gives you a little bit of background that's consolidated from 2 years' worth of discussion on a pretty tough issue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kinski.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I have a question for the sponsors, and I'm just curious if you contemplate that within the rulemaking there'll be some provision for the role of discretion on the part of the department, because I may have Company X that's up in the rotation and they don't have a vehicle anywhere near the vicinity.
Can I pass them by and go to somebody that's got a vehicle near? Is that contemplated? And then the level of service and the level of complaints. And the reason that I'm tuned into that is I built an entire business resisting rotation lists. Because I would have referral sources that would always want to go to the rotation list, and I wanted them to call the person that was going to get the job done the best and the fastest. And I built an entire business based on that premise of telling people that had these referrals, I respect the list, but when you really want it done fast and you've done it right, call us. And so I'd like to know that that somehow that's contemplated within the rulemaking. The price gouging, I don't know what to do about that one. That's a tough one because now you're putting the department in the price control. You know, now we're imposing price controls, and I don't know what to do about that one. But I certainly understand the need for the bill. I'm just curious about the rotation to the
Senator Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And some of my colleagues on the Transportation Committee, I'm starting to jump in, but as I recall the testimony, one of the big thrusts of this is that if you have a wreck on the highway, the main thing that the Highway Patrol is interested in is prompt service, get the car out of the way, take care of any injuries that might occur. So I'm sure that in terms of the rotation list, it's going to be with that objective in mind. Because certainly if there was a company from northern part of the state and the wreck was in the southern part, they certainly wouldn't call the company in the northern part. I'm sure there's going to be some discretion, some type of mechanism to make sure that they do the job as quickly as possible with the ultimate objective of safety. Thank you.
Senator Meyer.
And a little bit to the comment about price controls. This really is voluntary. If you want to be in a rotation list, you voluntarily say what your normal prices are. Now, Utah went a different route. Utah definitely has got price controls. They have it on from your shop, the front door of your shop, to you take the mileage to wherever the wreck is, and there's a band in every one of these mileage bands, and then there's a whole list of different kinds of tows that are out there, and it is plain cookie cutter. That's exactly what it is. You know, if the prices look like a bag of M&Ms, because that's all you're going to get, brown, yellow, green, red. That's it. Those are like the prices on the thing. Paint it, and only on Sundays. So, you know, the thing is on this one here in the geographical areas, the good senator from Cheyenne was right on that because they want to know where that is. And they are going to have some flexibility in that. Because if you have a multi-car wreck, or if you have a wrecker that can't handle the job, like it's a large truck or a medium-sized vehicle or something, and they know what the equipment is that they have, even though they're up, they know they can't handle it. They'll go to the next guy down on the list and see whether he's got a big enough tow rig to go out and handle that. So, and they've been doing that anyway. A lot of it is just getting that volunteer price thing there so you kind of have an idea what's usual and customary in the industry. And the towing industry is kind of interesting because I was up in in Casper one time, had the hood up on my pickup, and these guys go around and they troll like they're fishing for accidents. You know, it's like when the snow comes, by golly, they're out on the road, you know, and they're looking for business. And the other thing you can do is that if you're a large trucking company or something, you can make it known to the Highway Patrol that you have a preferred towing company. You know, somebody that you deal with every time, you know, if it's one of these over-the-road big interstate trucking companies that got hundreds of road trucks running up and down the road, they can go to the Highway Patrol and say, we don't want to deal with the rotation list. You know, it's our prerogative to use this guy if he's available. And, of course, if he's not, then there's got to be a plan B. But, you know, there is that flexibility. They're going to work with them as much as they can. It's pretty much all voluntary. And I think that voluntary way is the way to go rather than what Utah did, which was just exactly price fixing. So many pound cars, so many miles away, certain time of the day, you're going to get so much money.
Sensing you're ready for the question, all those in favor of Senator Meyer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 106, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. That House Bill 106 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Hey, this is doing some stuff here. Uh-oh. Air reporting, it says. Senator Cole, go ahead. I
move the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
What happened to my paperwork? You've heard the motion. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion carries. It quit right at the last.
Did we lose them? Did we lose it? We lost it.
I'm trying to keep it.
It went black.
We have technical difficulties.
Okay, great. Let's see where we are.
Well, before we take the motion on the report. Okay. All right. Senator Anderson.
I got to read it.
Excuse me. We need to read in the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. Vice President, Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. House Bill 64, do pass. House Bill 127, do pass amended. House Bill 45, do pass amended. House Bill 108, do pass. House Bill 121, do pass amended. House Bill 62, do pass amended. And House Bill 106, do pass amended. Senator Anderson, 28, Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Anderson.
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Motion carries. So we have some committee reports. Excuse me. Messages from the House.
I did, and then they took my papers.
February the 25th, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number 375, third reading, passed. Mr. President, the bill listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 54, Election Code Revisions. Ayes 52, noes 7, excused 1. February the 25th, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number 384, Joint Conference Committee Report adopted. Mr. President, House Bill number 23, Next Generation Science Standards 2. The House adopted the Joint Conference Committee number 1 report on the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes 43, noes 12, excused 5. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Is that it? Marty. Okay, thank you. Senator Cole.
Mr. Vice President. I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning, Thursday, February 26th.
Thank you. Announcements. Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, just to remind the members of the last meeting time for House bills, which will be tomorrow at 7 a.m.
Thanks, Senator Case. Senator Meyer.
Yes, Mr. Vice President, your committee number 8 will meet up in 14 in just a few minutes here to discuss interim topics.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Senator Cole.
Mr. Vice President, your committee number 12 rules will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. and S5 to take up House Bill 205 engrossed, Revisor's Bill.
Thank you. Senator Geis.
Mr. Vice President, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, Water Resources, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock as a joint meeting with the House to do interim study.
Thank you. Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. Committee number 6, Travel, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. over in H-10 in the House, and we will discuss interim topics.
Thank you. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. Your committee number 3, Revenue, will meet Monday, 8 a.m. over in room H-11 on the House side to discuss interim topics.
Thank you. Any other announcements? Hearing none, you've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate shall stand adjourned until 9:30, Thursday, February 26th.